Protesters against gang rapes in New Delhi saying stop this atrocity. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh pledges to take action to protect India's women.
Safety and security of women is of the highest concern to our government. A commission of inquiry is being set up to look into precisely these issues in the capital.
Singh's pledge comes after the brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old woman brought new attention to the issue in India. New reports say Africa's largest animals are being poached in near record numbers, among them more than 600 South African rhinos for their horns, compared to just a few annually a decade ago. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. As a journalist, Jose Antonio Vargas has covered a lot of big stories, from the 2008 presidential campaign to the Virginia Tech shooting to profiles of figures like Al Gore and Mark Zuckerberg. But he may be best known for an essay he wrote a year ago in the New York Times Sunday magazine in which he revealed his status as an undocumented immigrant. Turns out Vargas, who came to the U.S. as a child to live with his grandparents, was unaware of his immigration status until he was 16 and, like every other 16-year-old, first sought out his driver's license. That began a series of uncomfortable decisions about how he would live his life. It led to challenges in his education and professional work, then ultimately to his decision to share with the world, about as publicly as you can, that he's not a U.S. citizen. Today on the program, we talk with Jose Antonio Vargas about the challenges associated with only knowing really one country, believing it to be your home, only to find out you are technically not considered a citizen of that country. We'll also consider how that personal perspective informs his work now, facilitating dialogue on immigration through his campaign Define American, which seeks to bring new voices into the immigration conversation. Mr. Vargas is in town to speak at noon today at the University YMCA and then again tonight at 7 at Lincoln Hall on the Urbana campus as part of the University-wise fall series Beyond the Rhetoric. The lectures at noon and 7 p.m. are free and open to the public. Jose Antonio Vargas, welcome to Focus.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jose, let's start with when you first came to the United States. How old were you?
I was 12.
You were 12?
Yes, I was 12 when I got here. And this was in 1993.
And how did that happen?
So my mom told me that she wanted to give me a better life, and I didn't really know what that meant. All I knew was I was on a plane, Continental Airlines, and I left the Philippines, and I landed in L.A., and I was sent to my mother's parents' house, my grandparents. Actually, I landed in L.A., and I thought maybe I was in the wrong country because I expected America to be, like, blonde people. And I was at LAX, and I'm like, where are the blonde people at? I thought Baywatch was L.A.,
right,
you know?
Right,
and
sure.
So, I landed in L.A. and I got there and I'm like, oh, maybe I'm in the wrong country. And then met my grandparents, my mother's parents, both of whom were naturalized American citizens. So that's how it kind of started.
So up until the age of 12, you lived in the Philippines. Do you have a lot of memories of that? Or
yeah. You know, I'm actually working on a book right now and I'm trying to remember my aunt, one of my closest aunts, said to me that it was almost like I was kidnapped because I didn't really, you know, I woke up one morning, my suitcase was packed. There was a cab waiting outside and my mom said, well, we're going to the airport. And
so no warning.
There was no goodbye. I was in sixth grade. I didn't say goodbye to any of my classmates or my cousins or my friends. No one knew I was leaving, but my mother and my aunt, and I was gone. Poof. That's what my aunt was like. It's like, you were kidnapped. You just went.
Did you ever figure out why?
So what ended up happening was, and, you know, as I got older and had to basically research my own life, try to figure out how this had happened, what ended up happening was the man that I thought was my uncle, who was introduced to me as my uncle, was actually the coyote, which is, like, I guess the person that my grandfather paid to get me to the country, $4,300. It cost my grandfather. My grandfather was a security guard. Mm-hmm. I think he'd made no more than like $8.50 an hour his whole life. And he saved up $4,000 to get me here. So that was the guy that was paid. And I guess at any moment, my aunt was going to get a call because we didn't have a phone. So my aunt was the one that has the phone at our house. And so my aunt got the phone call, today's the day, get him ready. And then my aunt rides her bike to my mom's house. Mm-hmm. And then they wake me up and off I went. I don't even remember saying physically goodbye to my mom. I just remember her, you know, telling me that I should bring a jacket because it was going to get cold, and then waving.
So it kind of, it almost sounds like the experience a lot of kids have of going to spend time to visit their grandparents for a little while.
It was like a very like, you know, and again, it was like the last thing I remember saying to me is like, if anybody ever asks you where you're going, tell them you're going to Disneyland. You know, like I was 12 and Disneyland in my head was like, you know, Disneyland with like Mickey Mouse, you know, right. and Donald Duck. And so I guess that's what I thought was happening. And I didn't know, I was 12. I mean, all I remember was being in the plane and thinking like, oh, okay, like I've never been on a plane before and I'm sitting next to this stranger who they told me was my uncle. It was a very, and even now, you know, now that I actually have to write about it, you know, writing, you know, this is what I do professionally. I have so avoided writing about this because it means facing it and remembering it and unpacking it and having these really uncomfortable questions to my own mother about, you know, things like why, Adam, it's just, it's really hard. It's been, I spent an entire career writing about people to kind of avoid writing about myself.
Right.
And now that it's like the cat is out of the bag, now I have to really do it. And it's really hard. And it's all kind of in some ways cathartic, I guess.
So you arrive in the U.S., 12 years old, you're living with your grandparents.
Yeah.
And for the next several years,
four years,
things are going along fine. And then one day, you know, you turn 16, and like any other 16-year-old, you think to yourself, well, it's time to go get my driver's license.
No, one of my best friends, Arvin, who always drove me around, was like, Jose, you're 16 now. Like, you can go get a license, you know, like a permit. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so I found a form at the library that said you got to bring, like, your school ID, you got to bring your green card, whatever that is. And so I went to the folder of my grandparents' room where they kept all of my stuff, and I just got the green card and, you know. And I went to I didn't tell anybody. I didn't even tell my grandparents. I just went. So I went and I rode my bike there and waited. And then I got through and I remember showing the woman my school ID, my high school ID and my green card. And she, the woman at the booth, she examined my green card very kind of quickly. And she flipped it around twice. And then I remember this, like it was like yesterday. She physically lowers herself in the booth mm-hmm. and like gets closer to me and whispers, because there was other people there, right, in line waiting. She whispers and she goes, this is fake. Don't come back here again. I mean, I was like, I, you know, like what does that even mean? And I remember, you know, just thinking like, oh, my instinct was she was lying. That was my first instinct, was she was lying. And then I remember riding my bike home and stopping at a corner of like Reinsdorf and Central Expressway where the Mexican market was, Mi Pueblo. And I stopped the bike and I'm like, oh, okay. She thought I was Mexican because my name is Jose Antonio Vargas, right? And when you heard the word illegal or fake anything, growing up in California, I just assumed that that meant Mexican, and I'm Filipino. Maybe she, you know. So I was going to go ride my bike back to the woman and correct her and say, I'm Filipino. You know, the Spanish came in 1521. That's how we got Spanish names. But instead, I, you know, rode my bike home, and my grandfather was sitting in the garage because he usually worked a swing shift, and he was working the night shift that night. And I'm like, hey, I remember – because he was cutting coupons for the grocery. And I remember when I told him, like, I had the green card on my hand. And she goes, what are you doing showing that to people? First thing he said, what are you doing showing that to people? The second thing he said, you're not supposed to be here. So that was how I found out.
Wow.
And I
To me, what was so astounding about it was that why didn't anybody tell me this, like, ahead of time?
Yeah.
Like, couldn't my mom have told me this? It's been 4 years, right? It's not like it was yesterday. Like, my grandmother, my grandfather, like, who else knew about it? Who else lied to me about it? Who else? So that, to me, was the hardest part, was, like, figuring out how my own family could have hid this from me. And then thinking, do they know? Because, you know, my grandparents, my grandmother didn't make it past fifth grade. And my grandfather, I think, yeah, he didn't make it through high school. Do they know how to get me out of it? This was pre-Google.
Right.
You couldn't Google anything, right? And I was just kind of lost. I was 16. It was 1997. And I just didn't know what to do with myself. Yeah.
So you wrote in the Sunday Times essay that I mentioned that you decided then that you could never give anyone reason to doubt you were an American, that you convinced yourself that realizing that you didn't have you weren't aware of any formal way to deal with this. You just decided you convinced yourself that if you worked enough, if you achieved enough, you would be rewarded with citizenship. You wrote, "I felt I could earn it." How did you then go about seeking to earn it?
I mean, my luck was, you know, I was 16 when I found out. I was a freshman. The following year, I was a sophomore. I had Mrs. Dewar for an English teacher, and I love Mrs. Dewar. Mrs. Dewar said I was asking too many annoying questions and I should do this thing called journalism. I had never heard of journalism. We've never, you know, we didn't get newspapers at home or magazines. I didn't know what it, there was no one in my family who was like a writer. Like, it just didn't seem like, I don't know, it just seemed like this crazy thing. So I went to the journalism camp, and I remember, like, seeing my name. You know, when you write a story, there's a thing called a byline. So I remember seeing my name on paper for the first time, you know, and thinking to myself, I was 17, I was thinking, wait a second, like, if I'm not supposed to be here because I don't have the right papers to be here, like, what if I'm on the paper? Right? Like, that was seriously my rationale.
That would somehow formalize, clearly.
Somehow it would, like, I exist. I'm on a piece of paper, you know, and I'm writing about white people and, like, black people and, like, writing in English and interviewing Americans. And it was, I guess, my own way of validating my own existence. So I was 17, and I've been a journalist ever since. And I remember when I was a junior, because I wasn't even going to go to college. That was not an option at all. This was pre-Dream Act. I graduated in high school in 2000. I remember going to the library and coming up with a list of things I thought I needed to do. You know, I thought, you know, because at that point I had researched what journalism was and what it was. And I'm like, okay, so I need to write for, like, a big paper, like the Wall Street Journal or like the Washington Post or the New York Times. I need to win some sort of a prize, like this thing called, like, a Pulitzer, whatever that is. I need to be a political reporter because I had just seen Primary Colors, the movie, and political reporters are, like, you know, like, that's, like, the cool thing to do. I need to cover a presidential campaign. I need to write for this thing called The New Yorker because apparently it's, like, this Bible thing. And I remember picking it up when I was younger and thinking, like, oh, wow, like, what are these $10 words they use? Like, what are these cartoons? Are they supposed to be funny? Like, so I had a list. And I thought all I had to do was, like, and really I spent the next, like, 10 years thinking I'm going to get through this list. And thankfully for me, my luck, and this is, I think, is really important for people to remember, every undocumented person in this country has at least 4 or 5, maybe more, people in their lives who support them. American citizens. I mean, I like to call them kind of the Good Samaritans kind of in my life. You know, if it wasn't for my high school principal and my high school superintendent, if it wasn't for a venture capitalist who sent me to college for free. Like, none of this would have happened. Every time, you know, there's legal, there's not legal. There's right and there's wrong. My whole life has been kind of in the gray area. And if it wasn't for these adults, these American citizens, white, black, of all backgrounds, who have really encouraged me to keep going, I don't think I would have made it through. Every step of the way. I remember when I got a call from the Washington Post and said, we want you here, you know, for an internship. My first phone call was my high school principal, Pat Highland. She was literally the first person I called. And I said, Pat, am I taking somebody else's job? She laughed. The first thing she did was laugh.
Yeah.
And she goes, what are you talking about? Like, you earned this. Like, you worked really hard for it. Go. You know? I remember when the Pulitzer happened. Like, I was really freaked out because I kept thinking, I mean, how long can I keep going? It just got to the point in my career where everything I wanted to do in the list, I did. And my deadline in my head was my 30th birthday because that's when the driver's license that I got from Oregon was going to expire.
And I want to get to, yeah, to that process, getting the driver's license and some other elements. But before we go there, would you say each of these items on your list, again, was sort of this idea of if I can tick off this list, at least in my mind, I'm validating my existence, particularly in this country, that this proves that I'm American.
If I pay taxes, if I pay Social Security, which I've been doing since I was 18, I have paid so much taxes, like I should be a Republican, which is, you know, be that as it may. I just thought if being American wasn't something that I'm privileged enough to be because I'm not born in this country or don't have the right papers to show for it, I actually thought I could just earn it. I thought I had to live up. I remember when I first looked at a piece of like unemployment form, you know, when I got a job at the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, when I was right out of high school. And that was the first time I had to fill out an I-9 form, which is like when you get a job, right? And I remember there were two boxes. It was either resident alien or U.S. citizen. I couldn't check resident alien because I had no number to show for the, to show for it. But I'm like, so what if I check the U.S. citizen box, but it says clearly right there that that's against the law? I was 19. Without consulting anybody,
yeah,
I just checked the box and said, okay, well, I'm just going to have to earn this. That's how I rationalize it in my head. I had to justify my existence. I had to justify being here. That I wasn't just, you know, that I wasn't just a menace to society, that I wasn't just a burden to society, that I was actually contributing to it.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Jose Antonio Vargas, a journalist who last year, after covering many big stories for several years for a number of media outlets, wrote an essay that appeared in the Sunday New York Times in which he revealed his status as an undocumented immigrant. Since then, he has become a prominent immigration rights advocate and started a campaign called Define American, which is dedicated to bringing new voices into the immigration conversation. He's speaking today on that subject at the University YMCA here on the U of I campus at noon and again tonight at 7. We welcome your questions and comments for Jose Antonio Vargas at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. It's one thing to check a box. You're sort of forced into that position. But it's another then to say, hey, there are things I need to have access to be able to get all of these jobs, like a driver's license.
Yeah, I mean, how did
you go about figuring out, okay, the thing to do here is I got to go to Oregon and get a driver's license?
So, you know, the Washington Post offered me an internship, and they said that I couldn't show up in D.C. The recruiter said, I can't be in Washington, D.C. without a driver's license. So at that point, I was 22 and I'd never driven. And I spent about 10 hours at the Mountain View Public Library because I didn't have a printer at home, printing out, researching, thank God for Google, researching the DMV requirements of all the 50 states, printing them out, studying them, figuring out which states, like, what do I need to get a license in which state? You know, federalism. Mm-hmm. And then realize that Oregon was one of them. And then you look at the map and you're like, Oregon, oh, it's just like up there from California. So I can...
It's a little more than just up there.
I know, it's up there. It was like it was a long drive.
Yeah.
And the son of my superintendent's secretary, Mary Moore, her son drove me. I had never met him before. He drove me. And he taught me to parallel park. Because I was going to go to Oregon and take the tests. And God forbid, I was going to pass the test. Can you imagine if I had gone all the way to Oregon and flunked? And guess what? I got a 71. Passing was 70.
Yeah.
I actually think the guy just felt sorry for me because I looked so nervous. I was so nervous. I got the license. And that license, you know, I got it in June 2003. It expired in February 2011, my 30th birthday, the day of my 30th birthday. And if it wasn't for that license, you know, to be an undocumented person in this country is to be obsessed with papers. Like your life. I remember once I dropped the license in a toilet at a bar in D.C. Oh, my God. I freaked out. Because at that point, Oregon had already changed its laws. So I couldn't just go back to Oregon and get another one.
Right.
Like that's how I got into planes. That's how I got to follow Sarah Palin a lot in Ohio during the campaign. That's how I got to go to the White House to cover a state dinner. Like that was my – the license was my only form of ID.
Did you have a Social Security card?
Yeah. I got a Social Security card and I figured out – because I didn't know how we got it, but my grandfather got it for me. And it was one of those when he finally showed it to me, it clearly said there's a number and it said not valid for employment, right? And so we went to Kinko's and he put a tape over it and we made photocopies. But here's the thing: every time I used the number, I was thinking, wait, like, isn't anybody gonna figure this out? And so I remember, like, when was it, 5 years ago, I got my first letter from Social Security Administration. They're like, hey, you've given us – at that point, I think I paid like $80,000 into Social Security. And I'm like, oh, so they know. They know I'm paying. And so I kept waiting. Oh, I wonder who else is going to send me a letter. That to me was astounding. Like the fact that people like me, you know, are paying into Social Security. And by the way, we don't benefit from it. It's not like I can take unemployment checks, right? It's not like I benefit from what I'm putting in, which I understand. Like that's the way the system works. But just to show people that we are contributing, I think in some ways you can probably make the argument that undocumented workers has helped keep Social Security solvent. And yet we're the ones getting blamed. You know, these laws in Arizona and Alabama and South Carolina are really laws that, you know, the economy is bad. People want someone to blame. And what are you going to do? You're going to blame the immigrants. Yeah.
So what compelled you ultimately to say, okay, I can't keep doing this. I got to let the world know this is what I've been living with for the last several years. And the world ought to know what I'm going through.
I mean, I think it started in the 08 campaign when I was covering the presidential campaign for the Washington Post 4 years ago. And you know, driving around, I remember getting pulled over in Texas because I was speeding on a highway trying to get to a caucus. Texas is a primary and a caucus. And I mean, I almost peed my pants when the sheriff stopped me and then asked for my ID. And the whole time thinking, oh, God, he's going to find out. He's going to find out. He's going to find out. And what am I going to tell my editor? I'm already late on filing a story. And now this, right?
Yeah.
I remember, you know, profiling Mark Zuckerberg for The New Yorker. And at one point, Mark was a really friendly guy, actually, turned to me at one point during the interview and just asked me, so, Jose, like, where are you from? And I could have easily said, like, you know, I'm right. I grew up in this area, you know. Yeah. But it got to the point where it was like I couldn't go to a friend's wedding in Mexico. I couldn't. I have not left this country since I was 12. I haven't seen my mom since I was 12. I can't even go to Canada or Mexico, you know. Like, it's just – and then watching a lot of undocumented young people, you know, friending them on Twitter, friending them on Facebook, following them on Twitter, watching YouTube videos of all these undocumented people, young people, you know. And by the way, the DREAM Act, the undocumented youth groups here in Illinois are among the most effective. Like starting in 2010, there's a group in Chicago that does like a national coming out week. They go to downtown Chicago, undocumented people wearing T-shirts, undocumented, unafraid, and I'm watching them on YouTube, and I'm like, What are you talking about? Like, I'm afraid. What do you mean you're not afraid? I'm afraid, you know, and after that, and then when the DREAM Act failed the Senate on December 18, 2010, I think that's when I really was like, okay, that's it. I'm going to go do this. I left all of my jobs. You know, I was working at the time. I had to be independent. I couldn't do this while I was employed by, say, the Huffington Post or the Washington Post or the New Yorker. So I left all of them and I had to be really independent. I save up money. And I kind of choreographed how I was going to do this. And I knew that if I was going to do this, I had to do it in a big way. And for us, that meant the New York Times and ABC News. So that's why. But yeah.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Jose Antonio Vargas. He's covered a number of news events and written profiles of major figures in political and cultural life. His career changed last year when he wrote an essay in the New York Times Sunday Magazine in which he revealed he was an undocumented immigrant. We're talking about how he learned this, how it has affected his life and his views on immigration policy in America. He started a campaign called Define American, which is dedicated to bringing new voices into the immigration conversation. We will have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question.
Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great that's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing immigration in America with journalist and immigration rights advocate Jose Antonio Vargas. He's on the U of I campus today to give lectures at the University YMCA as part of the Wise Beyond the Rhetoric series. He speaks at noon today and again at 7 tonight. Jose, let me ask you, and these are potentially a couple of pointed questions,
but
intentionally so. Have there been moments where you thought to yourself over the course, certainly from the moment when you were 16 and you learned of the fact that you were undocumented, have there been moments where you said, well, I think I may have to go back to the Philippines?
You know, the funny thing is my superintendent, Rich Fisher, who's like my dad, he taught me how to drive. At one point, right after 9/11, he took me to meet an immigration lawyer in San Francisco. It was the first time that we had like a big meeting with a lawyer, right, to kind of figure out what to do. And the lawyer basically said the only option, this is right after 9/11, is for you to go back to the Philippines, accept a 10-year bar for having been here illegally, then come back. And we got out of that meeting. I remember walking down Montgomery in the financial district in San Francisco, and I was already kind of internalizing what this woman said. Maybe that's what I have to do. And Rich looked at me and he's like, oh, no, you're not going anywhere. I'm like, no, you're not going anywhere. We're just going to keep going. Hmm. And again, so every time there's been moments like that, that's like, you know, I'm done. Like, this is surreal. Like, this is not a way to live. This is not a way, you know, I've spent my adult life so far, like, running. I've been running so fast, you know, like, it's funny because when people read my resume, it doesn't even feel like, I don't know, it just felt like it was a blur. It's just kind of happened really fast. And a lot of that is because, you know, I really willed my way into making things happen because of the list that I had in my head, you know. But the past year and a half that I've been doing what I'm doing, I almost feel as if all I'm really doing is claiming myself and running towards myself. And, you know, like, the toll that this takes, and of course I understand that there's the legal toll and there's the external pressure, but the internal pressure, I just got back from Urbana High School. I just spoke at the high school here, and apparently there were some undocumented students in the audience that I spoke to, and I just remember being in high school thinking, what's the point? You know, why should I keep going? Like, why don't I become what society, I think, expects me to be? And I'm looking at these kids this morning and I'm just like, I just hope that you find the strength and the courage within you to not say no to yourself. That when you hear that word illegal, to think that that's not about, that you are not illegal, that you as a human being, like, it's not illegal. Like, the, you know, the action that was made is, you know, that's illegal. The action, it's unlawful. But you as a human being, you're not illegal. And that's really important.
Within our political discourse about immigration, one of the concepts that you hear articulated and one of the concerns that is raised about folks that are here and undocumented immigrants is that are they gaming the system or getting ahead of those who are trying to work through
exactly.
The immigration system?
Oh, yeah.
How much do you think about that? Are there moments where you think, boy, there's somebody out there that is going through all the channels they should go through, doing
yes.
everything the way they should, and
following
the
law,
and they
going through the steps.
They can't yet get here to the United States, and you're here.
And by the way, that's the biggest misconception here, that I am not expecting for some person with a magic wand to get in front of me and say, oh, whoops, that's it. You're legal now. You're now a citizen. I don't want to bump anybody off. Knowing how crazy the immigration process is and how long the waits are, especially in countries like India and the Philippines, you know where I'm from, and I do not want to bump off anybody off whatever line they're on. If you need me to wait 10 years, 12 years, fine. What we want is a process. And frankly, what we need, and not just undocumented people, what we need as a country is an actual pragmatic common sense approach, a process in which people can come forward, right, and say, you want me to pay back taxes? You want me, you know, you want me to pay a fine? You want me to speak English? I speak it pretty well. You want me to show me the line? That's what I mean, I was following Mitt Romney around in Iowa during the caucuses earlier this year. And it was just infuriating to me whenever he'd go up there and he'd say, people should wait in the back of the line and reporters. And I'm like, isn't anybody going to ask a follow-up question? Governor, where's the line? Show me. Because if there's a line, I would not be here. I'd be in the back of the line. But there isn't one. But again, I think in this country, we've been so used to just calling people illegal. We've been so used in focusing on the problem that we actually never talk about the solution. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we want someone to blame. You know, the economy is bad. I'm about to go to Alabama next week to do a town hall meeting with the Birmingham News, which is the largest paper in Alabama. And I'm specifically inviting conservatives and Republicans and Tea Party members who support the immigration law. I want them to come and really to have a conversation and really have an open dialogue about what is it that they're anxious and angry and infuriated about, right? I want to have an honest conversation about that. Because again, I think we've done a lot of talking at each other and really not enough talking to each other. And we're not going to solve this issue unless we fully comprehend whatever it is we're talking about.
We have an email from Glenn who asks, if you were able to vote for president in this election, who would you vote for and why? And of course, I should point out that none of us are required to say who we'd vote for anything.
Yes. But, as an undocumented person, by the way, I can't even begin to tell you how many people come up to me and say, well, I'm sure you vote. I mean, I'm sure you've been fraudulently voting all these years. No, I've never voted. I paid taxes, I paid Social Security, but I've never voted. It's a privilege and it's a responsibility. And I am not privileged enough to be a Democrat nor a Republican. You know, what I do know is I think it's time that we really stop focusing on the parties and start focusing more on the issues. What I do know is that the Republican Party has backed itself up to a corner. Every 30 seconds, a Latino in this country turns 18 years old and becomes an eligible voter. Every 30 seconds. The same 18-year-old who probably has somebody in their family who's undocumented, who you call illegal, who Mitt Romney has been calling undocumented illegals. Is it any surprise, by the way, during the debate that the president was talking about undocumented people who are Americans and all but papers, and the whole time Mitt Romney is talking about undocumented illegals and all these illegal people who should self-deport? I mean, the rhetoric is just, is it any surprise that, you know, Obama, President Obama is going to win this election, is going to get reelected on the back of the Latino vote. If Mitt Romney loses, he's going to lose it on the back of the, because of the Latino vote. Who would I vote for? I think if, in terms of somebody who actually looks at this issue in a pragmatic, common sense way, it's no contest. But I wish, you know, we're a democracy, and a democracy functions when we actually have competing parties. And I really hope that the Republican Party wakes up and realizes that they cannot keep doing what they're doing.
There are, though, are there not, folks on either side of the aisle that recognize maybe that there's more nuance to this issue?
Yes, absolutely.
Because certainly there are those who have extreme views on either side.
Of course, of course. And I just wish that more of the moderate Republicans would speak up. You know, like people like John McCain, who was, for example, one of the co-sponsors of the DREAM Act, you know? The DREAM Act, by the way, is only one slice of the pie, but to me, it's kind of like a litmus test. It's like the sanity test. How can we not invest on people who we've invested on? So let me put it to you this way. So there's about 2 million young people right now in high schools and colleges across America who are undocumented, right? What do you want to do with them? Wouldn't you rather them enter the workforce and become tax-paying citizens since, you know, we've invested in their public education? Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't that add more to our economy and to our social compact? Instead, now we have senators who used to support this measure, Orrin Hatch, one of the original co-sponsors in 2001, nowhere to be found. I think it's time that we as a country, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, really work together on the issue.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions and comments for Jose Antonio Vargas at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. Have there been any repercussions since you wrote that essay that was published in New York Times Magazine? For you personally, have there been moments where you have found as a result of that its impact either something as direct as somebody from, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement reaching out to you or something smaller?
Yeah, I mean, I mean the only thing was they revoked my driver's license, so I really miss driving. I actually, you know, for transparency's sake, I ended up driving in Minneapolis 3 weeks ago now and got arrested. So I was in jail for about 3 or 4 hours and then was released.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Like driving is, I really miss driving. And the other thing is, you know, I've spent my entire career writing about other people. And so it's been very disorienting to all of a sudden, you know, as a writer, the three words that I was most scared of was I, me, and my, you know, it's like all of a sudden it's like I, me, and my. I wish I was just writing about this person. I wasn't actually living through this myself. And the hardest thing, I think, is realizing how privileged I am to be doing what I'm doing. Meaning, for example, you know, when I was arrested 3 weeks ago, if that were just another undocumented person, they would have been in jail and they would have been detained and likelihood they'd be deported.
So you think it's because of your role As somebody who's been a public figure, sitting there,
you know, in jail, I think that was the first time that I kind of realized, it clicked in my head that, you know, I am a public person now. It didn't really click in my head before. Like, right. I kept thinking, oh, I'm still a journalist. Because, you know, I wrote a cover story for Time Magazine in June, basically, you know, writing a story about the fact that I haven't gotten deported. And called immigration officials myself and say, all right, I haven't heard from you. What's going on? You deported, you know, 100,000 people or so in fiscal year 2011, and I wasn't one of them. Why haven't you deported me? Can you explain? And, you know, they're like, on the record, they're like, no comment.
We have been following the debate over detention policies
yes.
by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, particularly how local law enforcement agencies have been holding people on behalf of federal immigration officials. Some municipalities are active in their efforts to do that. Some have decided they're not. They've intentionally not made those arrangements. And we have some reports and a link on today's Focus page to reports that we did recently here at WILL on this. How would you like to see the conversation over such detentions go forward within the law enforcement community?
I mean, I think this becomes a question of what makes sense for our communities. You know, let me use this as an opportunity to pivot, for example, to driver's licenses, right? We know that there are undocumented people driving on the road. Why? Because like you, they have to go to work. They have to drop their kids off to school, right? They have to function. Yet, we, for example, here in Illinois, like most states, don't grant driver's licenses to undocumented people. Can you imagine how many other more insurance, you know, how much more people with insurance on the road, safely driving on the road, right, could we have if we actually come up with a common sense approach, right? When it comes to detentions, like who are we actually criminalizing? This is actually a very interesting news story. What's happened now is we built these detention centers. Now, mind you, who's profiting from them and who's building them, right? The criminalization of immigrants who are committing, you know, somebody driving without a license or somebody gets pulled over because of a taillight, somebody because really infractions, right, that then put them into the system. I'm not sure that that makes sense, and I'm not sure who really that benefits.
I want to take a couple of calls. Before I do, just a quick correction. I think I may have noted a couple of times that you were speaking today at noon, but you also spoke last night.
Last night at 7. I was going to try to correct you, but I didn't want to.
Yeah. So you will be speaking at noon today.
At noon today. Yes. Yeah. Please come if you can.
Let's go first this morning to Ricardo in Champaign. Ricardo, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Mr. Bob Vargas, I heard you last night and...
Oh, thanks for coming last night.
You were not... I mean, it will be full today, but I have a question for you because I felt that you made sense, but in Illinois, the driver's license issue is probably going to come up in the veto session.
Yeah. How do you think it's going to go?
Well, the Urbana candidates, both for state senate and for the assembly, both Republican and Democrats have all stated their positive leaning towards a possible bill coming up. They don't have a number yet. So I think that at least from our area, it makes sense for the law, for the legislators.
Okay.
But my question was pricked because it stems from the fact that you spoke to the fears. I mean, in Maslow's pyramid, you're talking to the base of why people would reject the undocumented. And I thought in the driver's license, you just brought it up. It would save, there's 250,000 undocumented that would qualify for licenses in Illinois. And therefore, if even half of them enrolled and therefore got their insurance, for all of us, insured people, that means everybody that drives because they have to be insured,
yeah.
It would lower our price
yes.
about $60 a person. and so many of the insurance companies, because they'd be taking in more money because there's more insured people, of
yeah.
course, they're co-sponsoring and they're in for the bill too. But my question for you is,
yeah.
because you are so... I mean, you're a protagonist in this discussion. You're not just a public figure. You are acting in ways that other people have not dared to do. You have listened to the DREAM Act kids, and you have, and your own risk factor has gone up tremendously, and you're still willing to do it. So that's why I ask you this. And yet you're willing to talk to the Tea Party. You're willing to talk to the fears of the construction workers. How does the driver's license fit into that? I mean, it's an economic benefit. That's a no-brainer. It's a legislative one because of the Latino voters in
yeah.
Illinois are becoming so numerous. So that's also a no-brainer for anyone who wants a political future. But you're actually confronting what moves us all. this is personal. How can you tell a little bit about why and why you're willing to address that and where that stems from?
That is such a wonderful question. I was just on a conservative radio show this morning in Birmingham in Alabama. And a kind of question like this came up. And I think we have so grossly dehumanized this issue, illegal immigration, by calling people illegals. We have grossly treated this issue in such an abstraction that we are now, you know, because of the undocumented young people that frankly inspired me to come out like this, they force us to look at people as people, as human beings and circumstances, and to kind of say, you know, I have news for you. Undocumented people are just like everybody else. They drive to work like you. They work with you. They go to church with you. They're at your grocery store. This issue is not segregated. This issue is completely integrated in American life. And to me, as somebody who, you know, I found out I was undocumented because I wanted to get a driver's license. I, you know, spent 8 years with a driver's license from Oregon. That was basically my lifeline. It was my lifeline. Is there anything more quintessentially American, by the way, than driving? To just getting in a car and putting Beyonce on and, like, you know, going to a drive-thru and... As a human being, you know, like, to me, it strikes at the heart and at the core of what this issue is, that we're actually dealing with people, right? Because I think we have so busily politicized it that we actually have failed to look at the human aspects of it, you know, like, you know, and this is what the DREAM Act is about, right? I mean, let's think back to all those Irish and Italian immigrants in the late 19th, 20th century. People got here because they wanted to give their children a better life. Talk to any parent, you know. You don't need to put any parent would cross any wall you put in front of them so long as you give their kid, you know, a better life.
To that end, I want to bring Ken from Champaign into the conversation because I think that's exactly the subject he wanted to raise. Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Actually, what you just said is what you should be saying about your mother and you know, your grandparents. You know, it bothered me when you hesitated in terms of your mother, but all I can see of the people that I know that have done this for their children is a huge sacrifice.
Oh, it's a huge sacrifice.
I know that in your case that it was hard because I know that what happens is you're not being honest in that regard. You know, I mean, before you came out, you know, in terms of being undocumented. But I just know that among the Chinese, I actually taught in Chicago at a university, and I've had a lot of, you know, exposed to diversity from various countries. And all I know is the huge sacrifice that your mother made in your family so you had an opportunity. And I'll leave it there. And wonderful discussion.
Thank you.
Just cut him off. My apologies there. But thanks very much for the call.
Well, I mean, I actually think people ask me what I'm most fearful of these days. It's probably seeing my mom when I finally see her, because I know I'm going to see her at some point soon. And the first thing I'm probably going to have to do is apologize for not realizing the sacrifice as early as I should have. And to tell her that, you know, that I love her and that I, you know, like, it's been almost 20 years. Like, how do you, you know, I think survive. I mean, there came a point in our relationship that I couldn't open any more of the letters. I just couldn't open them. I put them in like a little shoecase, you know, shoebox, and I just have them there. And because opening them means opening up this entire thing in my head and my heart and, you know,
does it feel
it's hard.
Does it feel to you like that's a separate life, the first 12 years of life in the Philippines, that's almost like an act one and an act two or in some way separated from the experience you've had since you came to the U.S.?
For me, it's like this is a process that I've been going through. I get rid of the fear. I had to get rid of the fear because the fear was all-consuming. It was like a Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe in my head. You know, it was like a Telltale Heart meets Catch Me If You Can. It was like, yeah. I didn't know what was happening to me. You deal with the fear, you face the truth, and then you deal with the pain. And I'm kind of in between the truth and the pain part. And what's been astounding to me is how many people come up to me, even last night at the talk, at the Y, you know, with the same story and the same, I guess I almost underestimated my own. I didn't know if people were going to relate. You know, I wasn't sure. It seemed a little too, God, this is so self-serving. You know, as a journalist, I'm trained like this, right? We have really high BS detectors. And so I was like, oh God, like, is anybody going to care? And for me, it's like, I almost have to feel like I'm earning to talk about myself this way. I have to earn what it's, it, I have, when I do this, I have to make sure that I'm speaking specifically, but also at the same time that the experience speaks to the universal truth of what people like me have to deal with. It's, I didn't really come out, you know, I just let people in. And that's what we're trying to do collectively.
Jose Antonio Vargas operates Define American, a campaign seeking to bring new voices into the immigration conversation. He'll give a talk today at noon at the University
YMCA.
That's
where I'm going right now.
Near the corner of Wright and Chalmers on the U of I campus. That lecture is free and open to the public. Jose Antonio Vargas, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a good week for curling up with a good book or an e-reader.
When everybody has broadband and a device, everybody has access to more reading material than any library has ever offered, for free.
For libraries, publishers, writers, and readers, books will never be the same. The digital transition today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session on this Thursday. Soybean futures are drifting lower, erasing some of their early advances that we saw in the overnight trade amid what has been a general end-of-year risk-off selling across all the grain markets, hitting the wheat especially hard. Beans also continued to be under pressure as we see continued outlooks for record crop production in Brazil. And we did not have an export sales report this morning, but traders, when it does come out, not expecting a whole lot from the corn exports. And That market's under pressure because of demand issues. Let's look at particulars. In Kansas City, March wheat at 8.19¾, down 4¾. July, 8.36½, down 5¼. March wheat in Chicago, 7.68¾, down 5¾. July, 7.87¼, down 4¼. March corn, 6.92¾, down 0.5. July, 6.92½, down 1¾. December, at 5.98, down 1¼. January soybeans, 14.20¾, down 3¾. July, $14.75, down 3¼. November, $12.99¾, down 0.5. January soybean meal, $4.30.60, down 70. January soybean oil, $48.33, up 4 cents. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.